I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East in the UAE, which, along with Trump-bombed Iran, joined BRICS last year. And tomorrow is the 17th BRICS summit in Rio de Janeiro. It takes place amidst NATO-armed genocide and Donald Trump's bombing of Iran and Trump's threats against BRICS. Under attack from the USA, BRICS is showing strains, while India is attacked in the global south for its apparent support of the NATO nation-armed Gaza genocide. China's Xi Jinping, Russia's Vladimir Putin, and Iran's Pezeshkian are set to join only by video. Xi Jinping, maybe not at all. Even this year's host, Brazilian President Lula, facing U.S. tariffs, is again having to monitor U.S. subversion of Latin America's most powerful economy. The man who coined the name BRICS, Jim O'Neill, said on this show that Indonesia would be an important addition to BRICS, but the adding of Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, the UAE, and Indonesia seems not to have sped up the re-engineering of the global economy that could have been achieved while NATO nations were tying themselves up against Russia and Palestine. Professor Paulo Nogueira Batista Jr. was chosen by Lula to reform the IMF before he became vice president of the BRICS New Development Bank. He's in Rio. Professor, thanks so much for coming on. I better start by asking you whether, on reflection, you think there may have been a process underway when President Lula, who's been ongoing underground, appointed you to the IMF before the destruction of Libya, the 2014 coup in Ukraine, now genocide in West Asia. Is that the main issue, really, at tomorrow's Rio BRICS summit, this long process of dying empire?
I think that's the tectonic change that we are witnessing in the 21st century. The U.S. and the rest of the West, the political West, are in relative decline. And not only in economic, but also in political and cultural terms, in moral terms even. The West declines also as a moral force because of the support it's giving to the genocide in Gaza. Now, the BRICS need to take a stance on that. They need to take a stance on the genocide that is occurring in Gaza. And I hope there will be sufficient support for that in the summit in Rio.
But isn't the fundamental problem, and I know you know it up close and personal, that BRICS leaders never seem to have understood the intentions of NATO leaders and NATO elites? Putin folded, he was fooled by the Minsk agreement. Lula was imprisoned. I mean, he should know. India set up against Pakistan with all these military deals with the United States now. China set up over Taiwan, the Xinjiang fake genocide. South Africa destroyed by the IMF. Those are the founder members. They didn't seem to understand, despite, I suppose you would say, you saw all of this.
I wouldn't say I saw all of it, but I do think that the BRICS countries are in a learning process. And because of the factors you just mentioned and others, the trust of the BRICS plus countries in the West, in the US and the rest of the West, is declining sharply. This is only natural because we've been...
Sorry to interrupt, Professor. It's not a matter of them declining. They shouldn't be trusting it anyway. I mean, I know you've spoken about it before. Does Lula have spies, U.S. spies, in his own government? Why was Brazil's finance minister, Fernando Haddad, not even at last summer's BRICS New Development Bank meeting in South Africa? Lula not bothered?
What I think is happening here in Brazil is that the government is a heterogeneous coalition. It includes forces, political forces, persons that are Western-oriented and do not follow the line that I think Lula himself wants to see, which is Brazil as part of the Global South, as part of the BRICS Plus. For example, the Minister of Finance, he's absent, not totally, but very much so from the BRICS process, as you said. And that's not very important. That's very problematic because the financial and economic side of the BRICS is fundamental. So if the finance minister of Brazil is not engaged, this weakens Brazil's roles, and also the BRICS themselves, you know. So it just goes to show that Brazil is not really unified, politically speaking, in the issue of BRICS Plus, relations with the West. There are a lot of internal divisions, and including inside the Lula government, in my view.
You're being very kind, I mean, I know you've tweeted, many people have infiltrated the Lula government and who have a very different orientation. There's one thing to say there's a coalition of interests. There's another to say there has been infiltrated. No wonder Xi Jinping isn't turning up.
You know, I think infiltration is not the word, because what happened was in 2022 when Lula was...
I mean, you said infiltrated. You said infiltrated, right?
Well, I think it's not the best word. Why? Because what happened was a coalition was built with forces that are Western-oriented. So their presence in the government is regrettable from my point of view. But it's part of a process where Lula decided to, or had to, make an ample coalition to win the election against Bolsonaro in 2022.
And presumably it's these kinds of coalitions that are occurring in all these different BRICS members. You know, Jim O'Neill from Goldman Sachs, he was on this show a few months back, and he invented the BRICS acronym. He foresaw that de-dollarization, all these grand plans, were a long time off. What upset you so much about the speed of BRICS that you left your position of vice president at the BRICS New Development Bank?
Look, let me tell you, I do not agree with him on this point, with Jim O'Neill. Actually, de-dollarization is proceeding quite substantially, especially in one area, in the bypassing of the dollar and the use of national currencies in the relations between BRICS countries and with other countries outside the BRICS. So de-dollarization is going on. What is not very advanced is it's a construction by the BRICS as a group of alternative mechanisms and institutions. This has happened to some extent. For example, I was one of the founders of the New Development Bank in Shanghai. 10 years ago, I moved to Shanghai. Now, since then, the bank has advanced, but not enough. It's not the global bank that we envisaged back in 2014, 2015, to become a rival of the World Bank. So, but my departure from Shanghai, from the New Development Bank, was not due to a resignation. I was actually forced out of the position when the President Dilma Rousseff was overthrown by a coup d'etat here in Brazil. That was back in 2016. So I was suffering a mini coup myself in Shanghai by the Brazilian government, by the new Brazilian government, the Temer government.
Right. Okay, so you weren't that upset. I mean, I've got some papers here. Dollar's worst showing since 1973 after Trump agenda forces investor rethink. Although, some of the papers, this Japanese financial-owned Financial Times newspaper, China's industrial choke points, it says, already trying to destroy China in the mainstream media. So something is up in terms of the fear instilled by the NDB. Just for our audience, explain how. So the NDB works as the World Bank equivalent, and the AIIB is the equivalent of the IMF. Is that right? These are the two strands.
No. The NDB is indeed conceived, but not yet to become, an alternative to the World Bank. The AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, is a Chinese-led development bank, similar in many respects to the NDB.
So why have two?
Dominated by
China. But why have
because
two?
Because China wanted to have a... Well, I presume that China wanted to have a bank, a development bank, that it controlled more effectively. Because in the New Development Bank, all five founding members, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa, have an equal share in votes and decision-making in capital, you know? So we have a balanced governance. I presume, China never said that, but I presume that China wanted to have on the side of that its own development bank, World Bank-like, led by China.
And fundamentally, of course, the ambition is not to destroy the earth like the World Bank and the IMF have done over decades since Bretton Woods.
Now, it's a new approach that we're trying, that we have not achieved yet. But we want to have a new development bank and also a monetary fund of the BRICS that was created at the same time 10 years ago that served the purposes of the Global South in an equitable way, respecting national sovereignty. That was part of our initial plans, and we are trying to fulfill these initial plans with some difficulty, I might say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had John Perkins, the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, on this show quite a bit, who talks about his time at the IMF and how they was responsible for killing people who didn't support U.S. hegemony. Why do you think that people at the New Development Bank haven't realized that the sanctions regime imposed on Russia over the proxy war in Ukraine was the greatest imperative, the greatest advantage for the NDB? And now Donald Trump is seeking to end the proxy war. The gate is closing as sanctions relief is then going to happen for Russia. And the NDB may not be as relevant as it could have been if the changes had been made in the midst of the war.
You know, I would tell since my time there from 2015 to 2017 and after that, the management of the NDB and the shareholders have been quite conservative and timid. So the approach you just suggested was never actually considered after 2014 when the sanctions against Russia started, or after 2022. The NDB in its initial state has tried to play the role of a new kid on the block, but cooperating and learning from the existing development banks, notably the World Bank.
Are they employing people, failed people, arguably, from the World Bank and IMF? Is the NDB taking people? No. Okay.
No, not that I know of, no. Most employees of the New Development Bank are nationals of the BRICS countries. So we have little presence of former IMF in the bank. I was one of the few former IMF, perhaps the only one, but a sort of heterodox former IMF that always saw the IMF as a problem for the developing world.
So they're basically timid. Well, they'll be laughing in Washington at IMF headquarters. As an expert on these things, have you noticed any real profound trends in Chinese U.S. Treasury holdings? I asked the AI thing to give me a quick table. 2020, they've been decreasing U.S. Treasury holdings, obviously, the Chinese government. But, down 20% in 2022, down 7.5% in 2023. It's now at around $759 billion, $46 billion down on 2024, 6%. Can we see from these figures they are going to end U.S. Hegemonic power? They have to do it carefully, of course, not to crash the Chinese economy while they do it with their dollar bond holdings. What do you think?
Look, I think China is reacting very naturally to something very serious that occurred in 2022, which was the seizure by United States and Europe of about half of Russia's international reserves. If that can happen, anything can happen. And China is, of course, the main target, seen as the main rival of the United States. So the Chinese are very careful and they know how to plan things. They're doing the thing step by step. They're gradually reducing, not so gradually, in fact, they've accelerated that. They've reduced the amount of treasury bonds they hold in favor, for example, of acquisition of gold. Gold warehouse in China, of course, that's safe from sanctions and seizures on the part of what effectively has become a rogue superpower. The United States is behaving as a rogue superpower. And its European allies follow along.
Well, hang on, Professor. We just need to go to a break. Professor Paolo Noguera Battista Jr., I'll stop you there. More from the former IMF Executive Director and founding Vice President of the New Development Bank after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Paolo Noguera Battista Jr., former executive director of the IMF and founding vice president of the New Development Bank. Professor, before I rudely interrupted you, you were saying that the United States is a rogue superpower, but also commenting on the timidity of the New Development Bank as regards expansion of any kind of new world order. Do you think the genocide in Gaza, the U.S. bombing of Iran, the continuation of the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine will make some of the NDB people think again about their timidity? Is it going to be causing minds at tomorrow's BRICS summit in Rio to change and realize that they better hurry up about this. Otherwise, the bombing of China will be something to be discussed at next year's BRICS summit.
I hope so. But let me tell you, having known the BRICS process from the very, very beginning in 2008, what I observe is that all BRICS plus countries, including Russia, including China, including perhaps Iran as well, are countries that tend to be cautious in their relations with the West. In my opinion, Russia would never have started this proxy war. It was imposed on it, on Russia, by the West, by the US chiefly. China is not the country pushing for confrontation with the US. It's the US that's pushing for confrontation against China. So what I think is that these countries, notably the three that you mentioned, Iran, Russia, and China, are the members of the BRICS that know that from practical experience the amount of damage, military damage and economic damage, that the US and the West can do more than the other members. We also know, but we haven't had the very tough experience that these three countries, Russia, China, and Iran, have had and are having now.
We could do a whole program about your family in Brazil and about the history of exactly that kind of force used to subvert democracy in Brazil, obviously. What do you make of Modi and India? Modi, who signed up for the Quad Defense Pact with the United States, and Britain taking U.S. military arms and weaponry, supporting Israel, appearing to support Israel. Unlike the UAE, didn't even criticize the Trump war on Iran. Is that going to pose a big problem at the BRICS summit tomorrow?
Yes, I think that India has been a problem, and for the BRICS, I think. Perhaps the major problem for the BRICS is India. India is an outlier. I don't want to exaggerate, but some people even say that India is a sort of a Trojan horse inside the BRICS. I wouldn't go that far, but I do think that Modi has shown some strange things from my perspective. How can he support Israel? How can he have a good relationship with Netanyahu? When Netanyahu and Israel are doing what they're doing, what does that say about India? How do the Indian people feel when they see their president, their government, supporting a genocide in Gaza and supporting unilateral attacks, not supporting, but silent on unilateral attacks against Iran by the U.S. And Israel? I understand what the motivations of India are. You know, also, now, India fears China. And it has feels the need to maintain a certain proximity with the U.S. But that has become a major factor of weakness inside the BRICS grouping, in my opinion.
Except that India is part of the North-South corridor via Iran up towards Russia. Do you believe that Trump's bombing of Iran was really a signal against Iran's centrality in that North-South corridor, which makes it even more weird, the position of Modi in India? But is that the real geopolitical masterstroke, some might say, if you were working at IMF and World Bank headquarters, in trying to subvert and destroy, should I call it Persian civilization? Destroy Iran. In that will really severely affect any kind of strategies of the New Development Bank, of BRICS, of the new trade routes of this century.
You know, who knows what's in Trump's mind? Who knows what the U.S. is up to? I believe the U.S. has now a very erratic, unpredictable president who doesn't seem to have a clear strategy.
Well, we should be happy about that. Sorry, Professor. Surely we should be happy that it wasn't Kamala Harris, Holocaust Harris, as she was known. At least with Trump, there's a hope.
Well, I'm happy about that. You know why I'm happy about Trump? It's that he's doing the job of weakening the superpower that mostly harms the world. He's weakening the U.S. instead of making it great again. So in that respect, I think we need to be thankful for him. Yeah? But the way you asked me, what does this mean? Who knows? You're right. Iran is not only a very important country by itself in all respects, but it is a link between Russia and India it is the link, possible link between Middle East oil and China, bypassing the Strait of Hormuz. So Iran is strategically very important. And that perhaps is in the minds of Americans and Israelis when they are permanently hostile to Iran. Now, Iran should have had an atomic bomb a long time ago, in my opinion. Because this is deterrence acting, you know. Iran failed to do that, tried to cooperate, and now it has learned a lesson, I presume, and will go for a full-scale nuclear program, in my opinion. Let's see.
So that's praise of Trump yet again, if inadvertently, obviously, our condolences to the more than 1,000 who may have been killed or wounded in Trump's strikes, or the Israeli Trump-backed strikes. Trump may have facilitated the ending of Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa against nuclear weapons. You believe that's true? But you don't foresee Lula going to restart a nuclear program in Brazil to protect Brazilian sovereignty?
Look, let me tell you, Brazil is the only one of the four original BRICS that doesn't have nuclear armaments. Brazil has committed, a mistake by us, has committed a long time ago to maintain itself as a non-nuclear nation. Now, I hope that the Brazilian government is reviewing this and will take steps towards a change. Why? Because the world is very dangerous. And look at what happened to Libya, to Syria, to Afghanistan, to Iraq, but not to North Korea. So the countries are looking at that, including Brazil, and seeing that in this world where the Western powers behave as they do, nobody's really safe unless it can have deterrence, including nuclear deterrence.
And how can other countries learn from the experience of your hemisphere? I mean, while I suppose one can say Afghanistan defeated the United States, it's true. But in your hemisphere, Venezuela, the source of largest known energy wealth in the world, still perseveres against U.S. Hegemonic attack. Cuba, of course, is still there. Nicaragua is still there. Why is it these countries in your hemisphere manage to win against Washington, I mean, at great cost to their populations, one must never forget, in terms of the sanctions' impact on the livelihoods of the people of Latin America. Why is it they win, whereas in West Asia, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, they fold?
Well, let me tell you that Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, the three ones you mentioned, are exceptions in the Latin American context. They are countries that are opposed or being targeted by the U.S. in a major way. This is not true of the rest of our region. Brazil, for example, is not in open confrontation with the West. It has disagreements with the United States, with the...
They helped jail Lula, though. They helped jail the most popular leader in Brazil, the Americans.
That's true. They did. People here in Brazil, when Lula was arrested, I believe we can say, really, it's not a conspiracy theory. There was the hand of the United States there. So the United States really, is a superpower that can do immense damage to any country in the world, even China, you know, especially China, perhaps, because China is the main focus of American insecurity, you know? But here in Brazil, we have never been invaded by any country. But we do suffer from recurring interferences, political, from the U.S. We know that, and we are very attentive to what can happen coming from Washington.
I just hope all the leaders will be safe tomorrow. Just finally, I should ask you, what is the... Proxy war in Russia through Ukraine has created huge opportunities for de-dollarized trade, crypto, all of this. What's your NRC currency option to end U.S. currency hegemony? What's your suggestion about that? And do you think it'll be discussed tomorrow at the BRICS summit as something that there's an urgency about now?
Now, when I was one of the economists who have been thinking, I am one of the economists that have been thinking about creating alternatives to the dollar. My NRC, the new reserve currency, is one of many proposals. I've explained it several times in writing and verbally. I won't be able to explain it now because unless you want, because it's so technical, complex problem. But basically, what we need is a reserve currency, safe reserve currency. It could be created by the BRICS or a subset of the BRICS. Mind you, not a euro-like unified currency, but a parallel currency that would be created by the countries and to would circulate in parallel to the national currencies. So I don't believe, you know, that it's going to be discussed in this summit. No. In fact, we have moved a little backwards in this discussion. The Russians made some progress in that direction when they chaired the BRICS in 2024. Significant progress. But insofar as I can see, Brazilian presidency is not doing a great job in that respect. I hope
you
will change.
You should just call him up. You should just call him up, Professor. Just finally, though, I mean, what you know, Trump said 100% tariffs on any BRICS country attempt to de-dollarize. How dangerous is this to some theoretical ideas about new reserve currencies and mathematics and economics? How dangerous is it? Will they start killing economists as they've been killing scientists? That's what U.S. hegemonic power does.
Yeah, I hope I won't be a target because I've been one of the most active Brazilian economists in this discussion. Mind you that Trump was quite specific when he made the threats. He wants to defend the status of the dollar as a reserve currency. He said that repeatedly and aggressively. What does this happen? I do call my friends and acquaintances in the Brazilian government, often discuss with them. And the perception that I sometimes had, not of all Brazilian officials, but some, is that these threats by Donald Trump had an effect of creating a fear of discussing these things, which is unfortunate because it's an urgent, it's not an urging thing, but it's something we need to start to be able to produce something better than the West has done so far.
Some might say it's very urgent. Professor Paulo Nogueira Batista Jr., thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK EU-armed bombing of Gaza, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. We'll be back on Monday with a British politician who once backed disgraced Prime Minister Boris Johnson, only to now oppose the UK's role in the NATO-Ukraine proxy war on Russia. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.